General Burke's Real Six. Were the years that immediately followed the establishment of the Tank Corps, the years 1923-24, marked by any significant developments in training or in facilities at Bovington?
None at all. I don't think we did anything out of the way there at all, except train and train, because we were forming new battalions. And the great thing was to get as many people through these DNM, these army courses, as we could. It was just a slog.
Mm. Now, I know that Lindsay was appointed
yes, right.
Chief Instructor in 1924.
He took over from Joe Carter.
Yes. What sort of fellow was he, following Carter?
I'm very fond of George Lindsay. He took my son out on his first drive. After George Lindsay was a rifleman who'd been, practically all his war experience had been done in the Syrian desert. He armoured cars. He'd got very fruitful ideas. He was a good lecturer, very popular commanding officer. He had been a good boxer, and his actual technical knowledge of tanks was nil, but he was a very good, very very good commanding officer, very good chief instructor. He's full of good ideas.
Can you tell me something about these good ideas, particularly the ones that he was
able
to implement?
Some simple, silly things. Got an armored car broken down or in the ditch, you find that the instructors collected people to get it out. Now, George Lindsay wouldn't have anything of that. He made the people under instruction do it. And he had that sort of intelligence, which was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
He's very keen on welfare, too, which had been neglected.
Did he, as chief instructor, make any significant changes to the training procedures?
No, I don't think he did. He wasn't technical enough. He required someone who got a high technical ability to change that, switching from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, 1924 is rather an important year as regards changes in staff at Bovington, because we have Broad coming to take charge of the gunnery school and Festing taking charge of the D&M school. Was the influence of these officers of importance on their training establishments?
Yes, there's a good deal of change about this time, because most of us were running out of our four-year appointment. And so in the junior staff, as it were, junior instructional staff, there were changes. And of course, that followed in the top ones too. I forget who took over from... When Lindsay came, Carter, who had been chief instructor, became the number two. And Broad was there. He was succeeded by Pyle. But there wasn't any very great difference. I think the gunnery was a bit better. It seemed to woke up a bit.
Why was that?
Well, I think the profession, again, is the professional influence. Marshal Broad and Pyle were professional gunners. But before that, they had what I called improvised tank gunners.
Mm. Do you recall any ways in which their professional experience of gunners was brought to bear on specifically tank problems?
Well, they went in a great deal for permanent indoor ranges, which was a considerable point in teaching people to lay off and then to lay on and so on and so forth. And they built two or three of those. And they got the proper camp they built too, a brick one. It's all stability there, and comfort, of course.
Looking back over that period at Bovington from 1919 to 24, what was, when you left Bovington before going on to your posting at Quetta, what sort of state do you think you left the Tank Corps in as compared with how it had been at the beginning of that period, 1919?
Well, I think the embryo turned into a baby. I think that's really what happened. The thing was running. It was running smoothly, running very well, too. There were, of course, lots of things wanted doing. The most important two workshops had been divorced from the D&M school. They were a separate unit. But apart from that, the thing had just developed and it was stabilised. The courses were right and people coming in and so on. We got a higher grade chap to teach. It was grown up.
Ah, that's different. There's a difference between the embryo becoming a baby and the child becoming an adult or grown up.
Ah, oh, yes, there is, but it's basically they're very much the same, they're growing, aren't they?
Well, if you like, the adult is presumably at the height of his maturity, whereas the child is at a midway point.
Yes. Well, perhaps I put it wrongly, but before 1920, at any rate, the thing just went by hand-to-mouth sort of business. And after, in 24, the thing was stabilised. The thing went properly.
Mm. As far as you were...
Furthermore, they were accepted by the War Office that if you weren't qualified for promotion to captain unless you qualified at a D&M instructor's course, and the same thing with the gunnery thing. And so it was a qualification for promotion, so the thing was on a higher level altogether.
Yes. As far as you were concerned, in the period after 24, was there ever any return to those feelings of insecurity and uncertainty about the Corps' future, which you explained to me did characterize the period 1919-20?
Now, I think the thing that was properly established then, we'd got our own uniform, our own establishment, we even had our own hat, because the Berry came in then. And it was... We were disliked by the rest of the army because we were so good. It sounds frightful to say that, but we were all the sports and so on and so forth. The tank corps just won the thing. They said we used to pack our teams. We never did. That again was not the officers so much, it was the men.
Yes. I asked this feeling about whether there was any insecurity or uncertainty about the future after 1924, because from 1928 onwards, of course, in a very slow way, the mechanization of the cavalry began. And I wondered to what extent there were feelings within the tank corps that the mechanization of the cavalry was against the interests and future well-being of the tank corps.
I think from memory that if there's any instability in 24, it was really mostly on the promotion racket, which was much stronger than people thought. They hadn't begun to think of mechanization of cavalry. It is one or two advanced thinkers had, but the rest, rather, it was a bit early. That started later on.
Started in 28, didn't it?
28.
With the 11th Hussars and the 12th Lancers.
Yes, and they really weren't had much interest until after 30.
Yes.
They really came into their own. When I was at the War Office, 34, 35, then they really became mechanized.
Yes, but at any stage in the mechanization of the cavalry, was there ever any feeling in your experience that the mechanization of the cavalry was in fact likely to diminish the future growth of the tank corps and be a threat in that way?
No, I don't think so, except one, of course this is recorded, one held them in wholesome contempt, because when they started to mechanize, they did it with one eye on bales of fodder instead of getting down to the tank side. Even now, you know, they're rather inclined to pay too much attention to glorious paint instead of the machine themselves. They're regarded as amateurs. And there was no ill feeling at all. One was only too anxious to show them do what one could for them. I, for instance, did 2 months with the 13th, 18th at Aldershot in 1932-33, did their riding course and so on and so forth. That was part of the integration which was encouraged. wanted, it was the other way around. They were distinctly hesitant about it. Chiefly, I think, because vested interests. They were frightened of losing their horses and their hunting and so on, which one can understand because it meant a lot for those people. But they weren't. I should think to be a real proper mechanically minded chap, a fighting airfield chap, you want about 10 or 15 years behind you.
Yes.
About that.
Yes. I've always found it somewhat difficult to understand, or to, in a way, I suppose, I've always found it difficult to believe that the cavalry did in fact have this much publicized resistance to mechanization, because particularly by the middle and late 30s, when it was getting underway in a more systematic fashion, there can surely have been no doubt that no one but an office cavalry officer who was more blinkered than his horse could doubt that the horse had any future part to play in modern warfare.
They took to cars rather more easily than tanks. I give you a personal answer. When I was commanding the 4th Tank Army Tank Brigade temporarily in the desert, we were just going up into the Sidi Barani business, and the 7th Hussars had one squadron which had no medium tanks at all, no gun tanks, they were all light tanks, and one came up in A-10. And I took it over personally, about 5 miles across the desert. And Freddie Bias was commanding. And I said, look what I brought you. And he said, good God, Horace, you're overeating the pudding, aren't you? And he meant it.
Now, in 1924, you were posted to Quetta.
I posted the 1st Armoured Car Company.
Yes.
Which was destined for Quetta.
Yes. That was in 1924, and that was sort of 5 year period of duty.
Five years.
Yes.
Well, the tours were foreign service, but they didn't get an exchange after 5 years.
Yes, I see. Were you glad of that? Was that something that you were pleased about?
Wanted to. I wanted to go to India, and also I was married and I had a small baby, and we thought far better to get our Indian service over than cut across later on.
Yes.
And there were disadvantages about going to India later on when you were more senior, because it meant a break 5 years when you were away from the home service and the general progress.
Yes. In other words, get it over with when you're at a junior rank. Yes. Now, it was an armoured car company. What sort of armoured cars were they when you got out there?
We got them issued to us out there. They were Crossleys.
Crossleys, yes.
And they were quite good, but they were, as usual, under-engined. And because that made them rather doubtful proposition off the roads.
Yes. What was your sort of job there? What were your duties as such?
I had section, three cars.
Yes. And you were in charge of them there? Overall responsibility.
In the company, yes. The company had 12 cars.
Yes. Had you worked previously on armoured cars at all, or was this something new to
you? Yes, well, I had the last 6 months I was teaching at schools, I was down in the armoured car branch.
Ah, I see.
And we had Rolls Royces there.
Yes. They'd be probably the Rolls Royces that had been used in the war, had they?
Some of them were.
Yes.
Yes, some were.
Yeah, because they were knocking about for quite a long time afterwards. Did you go out of Quetta? Was it a sort of job of patrolling and
it was part of the frontier defence. Quetta had a garrison of over 10,000 troops. It was quite a big place.
Yeah.
And they had a mixed bag of infantry brigade and a Indian Army Brigade. They had a cavalry regiment and an armoured car company. And one used to do a certain amount of escort work.
Yeah. And in the escort work, you'd have what, in a column of transport or something, one armoured car in the front and two at the back or something like that? Or how was this organised?
Yes, that's really how it worked out in practice.
Yes.
I wouldn't do it now, but that's how it did.
Yeah. Did you run into problems doing this? Were there incidents that you had experience of?
What sort of way?
Were you attacked in any way, or was there any?
No, the frontier, the uneasy part of the frontier was on the other side, the Waziristan side. But Balochistan was, you had to take certain precautions.
Yeah.
There's a lot of thieving and that sort of business, but by and large it was quiet.
Yes. So you didn't actually run into actual set battles or anything?
No, we didn't.
Certainly there were in the 30s occasion, weren't there? What was the opinion of the regular army out there about armoured cars and about the tank corps which you came across?
Well, we looked upon it as the most peculiar people, quite useless for India, but very useful for the Indian army officers' point of view, because we had good workshops, we could repair their cars.
I see. A purely social advantage.
Exactly.
Yes. Didn't they regard the armoured cars doing this escort work with enthusiasm? Weren't they pleased that you were doing that?
No, they accepted one.
Hmm.
That's as far as I go, I think, with them.
Yes.
We were a very unfortunate company in a way, because they had so many married officers. Out of 12 officers, I think, from memory, 7 were married, which, of course, made things quite difficult. They didn't sort of mix in with the garrison quite much. They hadn't got the money. It was an expensive station.
I see. So they tended to go home at night and...
Exactly.
Yes. And so that there was this division, was there, built up anyway, yes, whether it was armoured cars or not. Tell me, what about the maintenance of the armoured cars at that stage? Did you have to do a lot of your own?
Yes, we had a workshop, of course.
Yes.
And we had a lot of engine maintenance, because they were under-engined. And, of course, big ends and so on and so forth went with strains. Transmissions were all right.
Yeah.
But we repaired them ourselves.
What about armament? They had a...
Armament they had at Vickers.
Yes. And that was presumably suitable, was it, for that sort of
well,
duty?
Well, it was all right, but you once you got it stuck in the turret, it was stuck there. It was a hell of a job taking it out.
Hmm.
They weren't sort of easily manoeuvrable outside the car.
I see, yes.
So you had to use the car as a mounting for the machine gun.
What about spares? If you needed something, I mean, presumably that took a long time, did it?
The spares were all right. They came out to workshops, but we had no great difficulty with them.
Yes. And you, as you were saying, you did a lot of your own maintenance, well, most of the maintenance, all of it.
Yes, what quite a strain on the workshops, and of course a limited establishment. What used to happen there was that one of the fitters from workshops would come up and your crew would work on the engine or whatever it was that went wrong under the supervision of the fitter from workshops.
Yes, I see. Did you meet Hobart while you were out there at this stage?
I met him in 20... when I was at the Staff College.
Later on?
Yes, he was just finishing his tour of duty there.
Yes.
And then he transferred, I think his actual date was about 23, 24, but he didn't come to anything until he'd finished his tour as an instructor.
Yes. So, in fact, we're a little premature on that one. Did you, in the armoured car company, did you take part in general manoeuvres and exercises that they
did? Yes.
Yes. How did those work out then? How were they used, the armoured cars?
They used them as for reconnaissance.
Yes.
Mostly for reconnaissance.
Yeah. I mean, did the work that was going on in England, there wasn't that much, of course, but was that filtering through to India, the sort of developments at all in tactics of use?
Very little of that. It was more go ahead, I think, in India than at home, because you had to have some form of intercommunication, and one had flags and so on and so forth, and you used dispatch riders.
Yes, I see.
But you did operate as a company.
Yes. And these flags, it was an effective system, was it, you found?
theoretically, they were very good, but in a very bright Indian sun, you couldn't distinguish the colours.
I see.
And also, if the wind was going in the wrong direction, you got a line instead of the flag.
I see, of course.
It's very difficult to see what they're doing. But they worked at close quarters, which is really what was required.
Yes. And you didn't have any wireless at this stage?
No.
No. Fine. Well, you were you didn't at this time do any peacekeeping sort of role for the armored car inside, any sort of incidents at Quetta itself? There wasn't any civilian unrest, was there, at that stage?
No, it wasn't. It was so overrun by the military. But no, it was quiet. I can't recollect any trouble at all.
Yes. Now, while you were out there, you applied for the staff college, did you? Is that right?
Well, in those days, you were put on a thing called a staff college list by your unit.
Yeah.
And I put on the staff college list before I left England. And it was transferred automatically to India.
Yes, I see. And so, in 1927, you in fact moved over to the staff college at Quetta.
Well, hey, I took an examination.
Yes.
There was a tremendous competition for places.
Yes. Yes. And did that examination include mechanical tests at all?
No, it was a purely sort of broad army examination.
Yes.
The administration, they had training for war.
Yes.
Which was tactical. That sort of business.
So it didn't give you, as having had experience of mechanical warfare at all, didn't give you any advantage at all?
No, never. It was a drawback, because it meant that you had a bakshi subject on which you weren't going to be examined.
I see.
No credit for it.
Yes. So, but in spite of that, you went there in 1927. So you left your armoured cars and just sort of moved over, as it were.
Yes, I left the armoured cars a year before that, because I was made staff captain Quetta.
I see. So that was a staff job, was it?
That was a staff job.
I see. Before going into the college?
Yes, before I knew I'd got into college. I got into staff college when I was staff captain.
Yes. And at the college, did you do any work on tanks at all, or tank?
None at all. Most discouraged about that. The staff college was a very high grade establishment, but it was small, and the year before my bunch went in, they'd had complaints that the life at the Quetta Staff College was too gay and too expensive, and people were going away without paying their bills and so on and so forth, and Army headquarters clamped down on it. They appointed an austere commandant with instructions that the place was to be run on austerity lines. Plus the fact that they had the most purblind bunch of instructors I've ever seen.
I see.
They were all very good chaps, but they were what they call South African war type. And the first year at Quetta, apart from the fact you learnt an awful lot from the people you were with, the standard of instruction was extremely limited.
Yes, I see. And certainly no tanks, and certainly no...
It got better the second year. They got one or two changes in the officer teaching. A fellow called Mackesy came out as a G1. He was the Times correspondent after a bit. He was a sapper, and he was very good.
Yeah.
We had another gunner who was not at all, he was quite good. But the test of that, of the teaching pool there, was the fact that none of them got to high rank during the war.
Yes.
And they all got a good start.
Yes, I see. And when did Hobart actually join that staff then?
He left. He left in 20. I went down in 27. He left In 27.
Yeah, as he was going, you actually met him as he was...
You couldn't get any leave when you were at the staff guards. And then what the instructors used to do was to take what they call...